following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
So how come they all came back? You understand, when I came to Israel 20 years ago, they still, in Israel, they were still using ice boxes. In Israel, well, you kids most probably figured 20 years ago they were using ice boxes in the United States. They weren't. Yeah? They still, there was no such thing as central heating, and they used kerosene stove. When my wife saw a kerosene stove, she thought three times what she did. Kerosene, you know. It's all right, we had bought a gas stove, and they still have little gas containers there. But it took a little while, because kerosene, when they came from Europe, you know what they had? Rocks. What they had? Outdoor latrines. We came, we had an apartment with indoor plumbing. You believe that? 20 years ago. Now, can you imagine getting Americans to come up here for outdoor latrines and no hot water. And what are you guys complaining about? Huh? It's funny. You could get them here. Nonsense. All right, but just D in the last point. There's D in E, and it says in the Torah, the prophets quite explicitly many times stated. You heard of Armageddon. The Christians have picked it up. They're waiting for Armageddon. And it's quite explicitly stated that the nations of the world will come against us here in Israel. Now, up until 48, the nations of the world would come against us in Israel. Yeah, in the land of Israel, we were nowhere near here. It was impossible for them to come. Right? But it's more the nations of the world would gather together to come against Israel. It's a little far-fetched. Yeah. And 48, anybody would say, this is a ridiculous prophecy. Yeah. But here, standing in 1980, and where the United States has given us an ultimatum that, when is it, November 10th, that we should leave the West Bank, right? And they have the oil, and we've been condemned by the United Nations of the world. How many times? Was it 105 times? Or was it 250? How many times? Close to it, right? Then you get a feeling that they might actually come. Well, read on with the prophecy. Read on. But it's a little realistic, yeah? I just want to say one other aspect of this prophecy is that the Ramban, who wrote about 700 years ago in the Shir HaShirim, did you ever see it in the papers of the Ramban? You got to find it for me. But they say that it's in the Chumash too in a few places. But he says that the Jewish people, he's wrote 700 years ago, he says the Jewish people will come back to this land after the nations of the world invite us to come. The nations of the world will gather together to invite us to come back to Israel. Now, can you imagine saying that 700 years ago? The nations of the world are going to gather together to invite the Jewish people to come back. The nations of the world are going to gather together. When did they gather together?
Wasn't it just Russia and America, basically, in Australia that were backing supporting them for?
You're talking about the state, but the nations of the world gathered together, and this is really all that they ever accomplished in the League of Nations. Did you ever hear that one, Chaim?
Yeah.
The League of Nations? And they issued a call to the Jewish people to gather from the diaspora and construct a homeland in both sides of the Jordan. And they instructed the British to hold both sides of the Jordan in trust. They mandated the British to hold both sides of the Jordan in trust for the Jewish people until they could gather together and run their own land. Can you imagine that? It's of course Perfidious Albion, the British, cut off half of it, another quarter, then they didn't want to give anything, right? But the fact is that that invitation was issued, and that itself is a mind-boggling promise. That they would invite the Jewish people. Look at how many times they've regretted it since. Yeah? They invited us. Can't get away from it. They invited us. Now, a second prophecy, which is a mighty prophecy, but it's a little different, a different style, is that in the second prophecy it says that Abraham had two sons. He had two sons. And one prophecy is that the Jewish people who came from Isaac will be a nation and will survive as a nation. The other prophecy says in the Torah that Abraham asks the Almighty, what about Yishmael? I have another son, Yishmael. How about him? And the Almighty says to Abraham, Yishmael Shmaticho, I've heard you. Gam hu yiyel legoy gadol. He will also be a great nation. He will also be a great nation. Now, if you look at that time, what nations existed? There was the Babylonians, and there was the Melech Shinhor. There were a whole list of them. Yeah, they were the great nations. They were the nations then. And there's been nations since then. The Romans, the Carthaginians, they've all gone. You know, the two nations that are mentioned in the Torah that we can identify that are existent today are the Jews and the Arabs. They are the children of Ishmael. That's a mighty prophecy. You see that? What do you say, Paul? Mighty prophecy. All right. A third instance of a prophecy in the Torah, and it says, if you read the Bible, and this is in Deuteronomy, the 29th chapter, sentences 21 to 27. It says over there, V'yomer ador ha'achon, and they will say, the last generation, your children, that will stand up after you, and the stranger from a far-off land, that comes from a far-off land, the stranger that comes from a far-off land. And they will see the desolation in this land, that it is destroyed, nothing is growing, not even grass, like the overturning of Sodom and Amorah. And they will say, all of the nations, why did God do this to this land? Why was he angry, this mighty anger? And they will say, the strangers, the nations will say, because the Jewish people left their covenant with God that their fathers made when he took them out of Egypt. And they worshiped strange gods and they bowed to them. So the Almighty was angry at them, and he threw them out of the land. Read that prophecy. It's fascinating. Deuteronomy 29, 21 to 27. So in the Bible it says there that your children, the last generation, it's talking about the last generation, the Dor HaAchron, the last generation before what? Before the Messiah, right? Your children, the last generation, and the strangers from a far-off land, far off. No. They will be in this land, and they will say, how come this land of milk and honey? They'll know that this land once, I mean, if you go to the desert of Sinai or the Sahara, you don't ask what's ruined, you know, why did the Almighty blast this land? It's a desert, yeah? But they will know that this is the land of milk and honey. What happened here? Nothing growing? Barrenness? And the stranger will say, the Almighty who did this, because they left the covenant and they worshipped idols and he dispersed them amongst the nations. The stranger will say that, not your children. How do you like that one? So if you consider that when the Jews got back to Israel This land, when I came the first time 20 years ago, was barren hills, nothing growing. We've replanted it, yeah? But it was barren. You go look out the window from the base medrash, you know, look towards the Jordanian side. You know, barren, nothing growing. Barren hills. This was a land of milk and honey. What happened? So the stranger from a far-off land will know. He will be aware of the fact that we had a covenant with God. He took us out of Egypt. And he promised to disperse us amongst the nations. And they will give credit to the Almighty for doing it, not the children. The children say, well, let's go about reconstructing normal things. So here's a prophecy that the nations of the world, the Goyim, will know of our Torah. They will not be Jews, but they will still believe in our Torah. Do you understand? They will believe in our Torah. They will know that our Torah, our Bible is a true Bible. They will accredit it, and they will not be Jews. And it will be a time when this land will be barren, and the Jews will be back here. The children, the Dor Achron, the children will be here. And the children will not believe this. And the Goyim will. Do you see this? Fantabulous. Okay, but you get the point over here. Do you see that? You have to read it yourself. But pay attention to what is being said there. Yeah? Pay attention. The Goyim will know. And that means that they're not Jews. And they will believe. They will believe this whole story. And the Jews will not. And the facts will be that it will be a desolate land. And the Jews will have come back after the dispersion. Huh? It's all there. Beautiful. All right, number four is a little prophecy, not that dramatic, but it says in the Torah, you see, it says in the Torah that there is one animal that has split hooves and does not chew its cud. And that's the pig. And the rabbis say in the Gemara and Chulin, the rabbis say, who was this guy Moses? What do you go on record to say there's one animal that has split hooves and does not chew its cud? After all, was he a mighty hunter? Did he see in the deeps of Africa? Did he go to the north, to the reaches of the north? They didn't talk about, did he see what kind of animals are roaming in Australia or in the United States or in South America? Well, there's many various animals. What are you going on record? There's only one animal with split hooves that does not chew its cud. What are you talking about? They say, except that God told them. That's a little one. Yeah? Do you see that? Okay, the third category of proof is what we call the genius category. The genius category, we don't have that much time to discuss it, but that's really the category that you'd expect to find the most convincing. The genius of the Almighty is just is not going to be the same as man's, right? Genius is overwhelming. So let me just clue you in, and I don't expect you, because you have to be able to see the genius and know it's superhuman to appreciate that it's the genius of God and not of man. But I'll tell you the story of a couple of proselytes, a man and a woman, German, who were lawyers in Germany. And they came to Israel and they became Jews. What happened? What did they see? They got a gift. Can you imagine a gift that will turn you from German lawyers into converts and come to Israel? Yeah. What kind of a gift was it? It was just a gift. What was the gift? Somebody gave him a translation of a volume of Maimonides. And that volume was on a treatise on their field. Their field was damages, torts. Yeah. Damages. You damage someone, you have to pay him. Yeah, that was their. They were experts in that field. That was their. They took cases, suing for damages, culpability, defending against claims of damages. That was their field. Right? Somebody felt, you know what? It's a nice curiosity for them, right? So you give them a translation of a volume of the Rambam, which deals with that field. Is that a nice gift to give? You gave them a gift of Judaism. How does that happen? They got this gift. It's a very slim volume. It's just a translation of the Rambam himself, none of the commentary. Now, it happens to be that the volume also contains murder and also returning a lost object. Also, there's a few things that have nothing to do with damages, right? But there are two chapters of it are on damages. So it's a slim volume, and there's a slim portion of it that dealt with their field. Yeah? Something like, I don't know how many pages, maybe 50 pages. 50 pages, a little pamphlet. Yeah? So they ask this fellow who gave him a gift, they ask him, what is this? You know, what is it, a report, a case history? You understand, 50 pages is one case history. What is this? He said, well, this is the Jewish instructions, the Jewish code of law that involves all the field of damages. Did you get that? A little volume like this. Did you ever go to a lawyer's office? Yeah. Right? You see, volumes, volumes, case histories, laws, volumes, volumes. Yeah? Right? And he's telling them, this is the law. This is it. Yeah. This is the whole thing. So he said, you're crazy. You're absolutely mad. Impossible. He said, look, I didn't write it. My mommy's wrote it. Leave me alone. Yeah? I don't know for nothing. Well, they were intrigued. They figured, let's read it. So they read it. They saw it's an altogether different approach. It's not case history. It's principles. It's principles. You understand the principles, you're supposed to apply it to different situations. That's all. Just principles. I said, let's see if it works. And they started going through case histories and asking, how would it, and they wound up in Tel Aviv as converts. They said, no man could do this, only God. Now you have to be a lawyer. You have to read Maimonides. You have to have the curiosity to see whether this is so or not, right? I'm just telling you how it works. You get that? Okay, so the first instance that I'm going to give you in this category is something that just you should appreciate with your mind. With your mind. It's not that you appreciate the direct genius, but just with your mind. And that is that the Jewish way of studying Torah, the Jewish way of studying Torah is by questions and answers. If you want recognition in a yeshiva, where they study the Torah, where they study the instruction in Talmud, etc., you have to ask the right questions. Answers, but you become famous when you have a question that nobody else asks. The whole Beis HaMedrash, the whole study hall buzzes. He got a question, it's not in the Rishonim, nobody asked it. Wow! Yeah? Answers this guy will give you. That answer, you'll argue about the answers, etc. We're not worried about answers. But a question, a new question, wow! This is the way you get prestige in the yeshivas. You understand? Now, Western consciousness, you see, everybody treasures, I don't know, most probably it's a little too expensive today, but in my days they used to treasure the first pair of shoes that their children wore. They used to put gold plating on it, silver plating, bronze plating. You ever see any of those things? Yeah? Your shoes gold plated, children's shoes, no? Your parents? Anybody here? Yeah? All right, parents, hold it. Why? Because the mark, it's beautiful. You have to have children. It's beautiful, the first steps he takes, the first steps. This is a new world already. He's a bit of a human being, a bit of a man. Yeah? Not crawling around like a wolf. He's a human being. You get it? Beautiful. And it, sentimentality. He gets it. You know what a Jewish family treasure? You know what I treasure for my first son? The first kasha he has. The first contradiction that he found. I can tell it to you if we had the time. The first contradiction. And my son came back from Cheder, and he asked, how could it be? Huh? Found the contradiction. Maybe it was 6 years old. Yeah? How could it be? So the next 100 people that came into the house So you want to know what my son asked? You want to know what my son asked? And he's listening and he's very proud of himself, right? Now you understand that the next 3 months we were plagued with all kind of questions. This is not this. We were plagued with all kind of questions. He was trying to hit another one, you know? You hit the jackpot, you try again, right? If you get recognition for a question, what do? You try again. Let's see if I can find another discrepancy, another one, you know? You get that? That's proof that the Torah was given by God. Why? Because you see, my friends, you know that any man-made manuscript, you keep looking for discrepancies, you'll tear it apart. Not in one generation, but in 20 years. I mean, everybody's looking for discrepancy, and you find another one, boy, you got a reputation. Wow. Human beings are just not that consistent. Do you follow them? Now remember, don't think that it's like, you know, well, we rationalize the answers. Not true. Not true. You give an answer, we don't rationalize it. If we don't have an answer, we say, kasha, difficult. The Gemara stays with a few of them. Rashi stays with a few of them. You know, you don't have an answer. You don't have to give an answer. The important thing is that the answer has to be real. So if you don't whitewash it, and you're just asking questions, and another question, another question, another question, right? Well then, you're going to tear apart a man-made document. Did you get that? Doesn't convince you yet? Well, let's get some report.
Saying it won't stand up to
scrutiny? A man-made document? Let's take a social, a book on an economics written by someone. Yeah? We'll tear it apart. Yeah? How many mistakes are you going to find? A book on social work? How many mistakes are you going to find? A book on law? How many mistakes are you going to find? How many mistakes? Now, you're talking about a book that carries law, social contract, history, morality, yeah? How many contradictions are you gonna come up with if it's man-made? Impossible. It's man-made, it's impossible. Alright, so number three is, number two of the illustration is that I'll give you a few instances of how we use questions and the genius that is inherent in the answers. Now, we're here. We can't do that much, right? But I'll give you a few instances, right? So the first instance is something that anybody who's read the, did you ever read the Bible? How many people read the Bible from cover to cover? Come on, how many? Yeah, one. Did anybody ever read the first chapter? How many people read the first chapter? Huh. So you remember about the Garden of Eden? There were two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. You remember that one, right? Now doesn't that really smell, reek of mythology, a tree of life and a tree of knowledge? Yeah? The point that we want to make first is that we all who don't know the genius of the Torah, we all look at it, well, come on, you know, a fable, a story, he ate from the tree of knowledge, and the Almighty kicked them out. The Almighty said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge, and he ate from the tree of knowledge, and because of that, death came into the world, and the Almighty said, don't eat from it, because the day you eat from it, you will die. And he went and ate from it. Death came into the world. The Almighty said, I'll have to kick him out of the Garden of Eden because otherwise he'll eat from the tree of life and he will not be able to die. You remember that? Yeah? It sounds so far away. And what's the difference? What is it telling us? Not relevant. Bubba Mises. Yeah? Okay. So now, really, you should use the Jewish way of study. And the Jewish way of study is what kasha, what contradiction is there inherent in that story? That's our path to find what it's talking about, you see. What contradiction is inherent in that story? The Almighty created the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the fruit of that tree was tremendously attractive, right? And he said, don't eat from it, because the day you eat from it, you will die. What's wrong with that statement? What is it, a trap? He created a trap, and it's a tree of knowledge? Is it a good tree? Do we need it or we don't need it? He created this fruit of knowledge, the tree of knowledge. Eitz hadas. Not to eat from it. Don't eat. There's something wrong. We see there's something wrong. Right? Yeah? Okay, now, what's the Jewish way of answering it? Yeah? Could Adam have eaten from that tree of knowledge according to the reading of the text? Sure he could have. And of course it was created to eat from it. How could he have eaten from
it?
If he would have eaten the tree of life, then he couldn't die. So the Almighty said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge because you will die if you eat from it. Yeah? But the great man, he went and ate from the tree of knowledge first. If only he had patience. First eat from the tree of life. The Almighty told him to eat from all the trees. And that includes the tree of life. Yeah? Now it makes sense. The Almighty gave him the tree of life, the tree of knowledge. He told him, eat from all the trees, which would include the tree of life. And then he can eat from the tree of knowledge. Yeah? Interesting story. Interesting tragedy. Yeah? And do you realize how close that tragedy is to us for all time? We are the sons of man. We do the same constantly. Do you see how? What's the tree of life? Anybody who knows anything about Judaism, the tree of life is what? Torah, the instructions of living. What is the instruction of living? Wisdom. What is your greatest pleasure? How do you make a decision? How do you know whether something is right or wrong? What do you want? What is the battle between good and evil? What is love? What do you want out of life? What is your purpose in life? That's the tree of life. That's life. Know yourself. And what's the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Experience. I will learn from experience. I will wander the streets of Paris and I will experience and I will learn. But you don't know how to make decisions. But I want to feel. I want to see everything. But you don't know how to sell out. What's right and what's wrong? That's death. That's confusion. But I want to see it. Okay, so wait. First, know yourself. Know what you want. Know who you are. Don't have time for that. The tree of knowledge, good and evil. Do you see that? But we don't wait until we know how to use a machine. Yeah? How to use life. What is life? We want the experiences and we get thoroughly confused. Success, trips, vacations. Who are you? What do you want? Well, we'll settle that out when we're 70. All right, so let me give you another example. Another example is, here it says in the Torah, and it's in the Seder of the Week. It says in the Torah, it's in the Seder of the Week, that Avram, our father Abraham, is talking to God Almighty himself. Right? He's talking to God. And he picks up his eyes and he sees three guests. Strangers, walking down the street. So he says, pardon me, God. I have to take care of my guests. Get that one? Now, the rabbis very calmly make a decision. And according to the instructions of the Torah, the rabbis, and if you take it seriously, just in case, my friend, the Almighty does come to you and you have a nice conversation with him, if you get a knock on the door and you have some guests, you're supposed to say, Mikan, from this, Avraham Avinu was a good man. Then the responsibility is, Mikan, Shagodl Achnosis Ochim, Kabbalah Smeashkin. It's greater. You have to say, pardon me, God. You have to leave God and go and take care of your guests. It's a greater thing. Greater thing to take care of guests than to speak to God Almighty Himself. Did you hear that? Did you hear that? What do you say, Abram? Does that sound reasonable?
Not really.
Not really. I'm telling you, my friends, you can ask an atheist, a dyed-in-the-wool atheist, you can ask him, is there anything greater than speaking to God Almighty Himself? Can there be a greater experience for human beings than to speak to God Almighty Himself? What do you say? Even an atheist will agree. If you could speak to God Almighty Himself, that's it. Right? Is that right, Abram?
Yeah.
Even an atheist would agree on that, right? So what the heck are they talking about? That it's a greater thing to hospitality. Big deal. I don't know, not. That's the kash. That would be what we consider a contradiction, a discrepancy. We worry about it. We wonder about it. What did they say? What's it talking about? Doesn't make sense. Yeah? All right, so you read a couple of lines more. This is the way you study Torah. You read a couple of lines more. And it says that this fellow, Avraham Avinu, this Avraham Avinu, our forefather, Abraham, how does he greet the guests? You know what he does? Avraham Avinu. He lies down flat on the floor. He bows to them. Flat on the floor. Bows to them. Flat on the floor. And he says, my masters, please come to the house of your slave. You get that picture? A little extravagant, isn't it? A little extravagant. You think it's a little extreme. Maybe in those days they... Strange. But you really have to appreciate the scene, you see, because this fellow Avraham Avinu says in the Sedra before that, in just the chapter before, it says that he fought four kings. He was a mighty warrior. Mighty warrior. He took out after four kings and he wiped them out. Yeah? With a troop of 318 soldiers. Yeah? Took on mighty armies. Can you imagine General Sharon bowing down to you flat on the floor and say, my master? Eh? Well, strange, you know, warrior out there. Yeah. My master? Besides that, in the chapter before that, it says that he was so darn wealthy. You see, they'd say, the better the manure of the cattle of Abraham than the treasury of the king of the Plishtim. You understand? The manure you can sell, yeah? You get more money if you sell manure. He was a wealthy, he was a magnate, yeah? So can you imagine Henry Ford or Howard Hughes bowing down on the ground, you know, and say, my master, please come to the house of your slave. It's crazy. Besides that, in the chapter before that, it says that he was a great philosopher, a great leader of men. Vayikra b'shem Hashem. He had a big yeshiva. People came to listen to his discourses. Can you imagine Professor, who's the great professor, bowing down my master? What the heck is it talking about? Ununderstanding. So, comes the Talmud to our aid. See, one question, another question. Still, we don't know. But the Talmud comes to our aid. The Talmud says that one time, the president of the Jewish people, also a great scholar and a very wealthy man, didn't have an occasion to be a warrior, but also a great scholar, a wealthy man, and a leader of men, a president. Yeah? He had a wedding for his son. His son got married. So he was one of the waiters. He was one of the waiters, and he brought to the guests, which is the hospitality, he brought to the guests, he brought them the food, took off the shirt. The guy, you know, the president. Yeah. So one of the students says to the other student, is this fitting? Here we are, sitting here, while the president, the scholar, the man of most importance is waiting upon us. That's not fitting. It's not right. So the other student punches him back and he says, we find greater than him that did it. Our father Abraham. V'hu omed aleihem. He served the guests.
So the other guy gives them both a punch and he says, "You idiots, you," he says, "until when will you discuss the honor of human beings and forget the honor that you owe to our almighty creator?" Do you understand what he was saying? Who gives you food? Who lifts your arm? Who sees your digestive system is working? But the almighty God himself. So they're saying that Rav Gamliel is doing only what God is doing. It's interesting. That's a piece of information. You understand that? Then you get another piece of information. And this one strikes a little home. It says in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Mishnah in Sanhedrin says, look, why did the Almighty create us all alone? Yechidi. We're all alone. We're born alone and we die alone. Do you understand how alone you are? With your parents and with your friends and with your children, every human being walks through this earth alone from the day he's born until the day he dies. The rabbis say that a man only dies to his wife. A woman only dies to her husband. The one who really feels the passing of another human being is a man and wife. They come closest. But there is. Otherwise, life goes on for everyone. It's a tragedy. You feel bad. Life has not changed because we're all alone. We're born alone and die alone. Why did the Almighty make us that? The Almighty made us, we understand each other. We can communicate, right? You understand me, I understand you. We identify subjects, beauty. We talk about philosophy, about meaning. We understand each other. He created us that we're one in understanding. Why couldn't he create us that we feel each other? Why did he go to the trouble to keep us all alone? You hear the question? So the rabbis say, "Kedei Shiyoma, the Almighty created us so that we will say, Bishvili Nivra Olam, the world was created for me." We're up here all alone. We look at the world. There's no one to share it with. It is my world. The world was created for me. Now this is the way we have to operate as long as we're alive. And the thing that 5 million Africans starving to death, what do you say, Doogie? What is your reaction?
To help them.
Is that your reaction? Or what do I have to do about it? I should help them. How would I feel if I was starving? You don't feel it. You have to put yourself in their shoe. For one man is, that's terrible, gotta help. For another man is, maybe this is a time to buy wheat futures. Yeah? For another man, it's... Do you understand? He thinks, how does it affect me? He doesn't feel anything. Right? I'll give you a better example. You understand? Better example. We cannot possibly react to another human being without asking ourselves, how would I feel in his shoes? We don't feel him. We say, what is my obligation after I think of myself? How does he affect me? Do you get that? There's no way we can overcome that. So that's the Almighty's intention. Yeah? Now there's two ways of looking at this world, you see. There's two ways of looking at this world. If the world is created for me, what are the two ways of looking at it? The fools think. The fools think the world is created for me. So what does that mean? Come on, what do you say?
If I can do whatever I want.
Do whatever I want? It's more than that. Yeah, Chaim, it's more than that. I can do whatever I want. If the fools say the world was created for me, so what? How do they react? Yeah?
As much as you can.
Not only that. All the cows are for me to eat. What are you eating my cow? All the cars are for me to drive. Why are you driving my car? That's the way the fools think. And if you think we're impervious to it, I ask you to remember a time when you were caught up in rush hour traffic. Were you ever caught up in rush hour traffic at 8:30 in the morning, you can't move? And you're standing there seething, yeah? And finally you mutter yourself, what are all these damn fools doing on this road? Don't they know it's rush hour? You know, you don't recall that? You recall that? Yeah. What are they doing on my road? Idiots! Do you see that reaction? My world! It's not intelligence. It's there. My road. But if the Almighty had in mind, he didn't think you're going to eat up all the cows, or you're going to drive all the cars, or you're going to drink all the beer, right? Then what did he really have in mind if the world is created for me? What did he have in mind? Think of the other thing. The world was created for me. So that you should take care of it. You should take care. You get it? Now, if you take care of this whole world, if you get rid of the atom bomb, pollution, bring men to love each other, you see, it will be your pleasure. You see, it's a pleasure, right? Now tell me, what would you feel like if it's your world? You would be like God. So now tell me, my friends, do we all recognize there is one thing greater than having God speak to you? And what is that? Be like God. And you know what the essence of God's nature is? He created this world to give us pleasure. This is a hospitality. You see the beauty of it fitting together. So to serve your fellow man means that that fellow man was created for you. Take care of him. I'm at your service, sir. Then you are like God. You try to swallow him, beat him up, manipulate him. You're as far from God as you can possibly be. What do you say, Jonathan? Is that just fantabulous beauty? But you see that it is something that you got to get used to understanding. I would just say a third category over here is that, look, there are concepts in that Torah. The third category is that there are concepts in that Torah that are mind-boggling concepts. Can you imagine the people 3,500 years ago, they gave us, we are our brother's keepers, you've got to love humanity, democracy, one God, tolerance, day of rest. All revolutionary concepts. Justice for all men are created equal. Judaism. How many years did it take for the world to to accept these? He's saying, one nation. Men created these ideas. I mean, this is just the dignity of the individual as opposed to the state. The state. The individual. Absolute right of the individual. What can I tell you? You gotta know how much creativity there was there. Man did it. Not possible. Do you understand the dimension that the genius that you expect human beings had way back then? To define it, teach it, and keep it alive in the people for 3,500 years. In the face of the insanity that is around us. Impossible.
Number 4 of the categories of proof of Torah from Sinai is the historical proof. Now first you've got to define what's historical proof. What's the difference between history and myth? There is such a thing as historical proof. An event actually occurred. So, for example, George Washington was the first president of the United States of America. That's one statement. Another statement is, George Washington, when he was a little boy, cut down a cherry tree. And his father said, "Who cut down my cherry tree?" And he said, "I cannot tell a lie. I did it with this hatchet. Now, which is history and which is a myth? Can you identify it, John? Which is history and which is a myth?
The history is that he was president. That he cut down the church.
Now, why? Why aren't they both history?
One of them we can verify from proof.
From objective evidence from the outside, from the fact that a people cannot, you can't lie to them about who the first president is, right? But the basic concept is a myth is something that no one knows except one person was there or not. Five people were there, right? Five people can tell a lie. You don't really know it could have happened, it could have not happened, right? That's a myth. History, it had to happen. Because a whole people knows about it. You can't tell a people who your first president was. You get that? In England, they had records of George Washington being president. There's objective evidence from the outside. There's objective evidence from the inside. So the first instance in this category is, what do you say? You see, there's this story about this grand rabbi, a grand rabbi who had three sons. Yeah? And he died, and each one of the sons thought that he was fitting to be the following rabbi. He wanted the position. Yeah. And they argued for a long time, for a couple of months, they were arguing about who should inherit the mantle of the father. One bright morning, one of the boys comes into the other two, and he says, I got it settled. Our father came to me in a dream, in a vision, and he said very clearly that he appoints me as the next grand rabbi. Now, what do you say? What should the other brothers do? They believe him? You know, they've been arguing for 2 months about this, yeah? So what should they say to him? They'll say to him, look, if our father wanted you to be the grand rabbi, he should have told us all. Is that right? Does that make sense? Should have told us all. How do we know you're telling the truth? You see that? Okay. So when you look at other religions, Buddha, Mormons, who was it, Smith, Jesus, Mohammed, he says, God appointed me as a prophet. And what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to believe him. Yeah? Right? Now, do we believe him? If you feel like it, you believe him. If you don't feel like it, how do you know? You don't know. Right? Really, what should we say to him? If God appointed you as a prophet, then why didn't he tell us all? Right? Well, yeah, you guys aren't fitting. Yeah, but how do I know? If he wanted me to know, he should tell us all, right? So, let me ask you. In the instance of the Rebbe who had these three sons, yeah? Why didn't the fellow who said that his father chose him, why didn't he come to his brothers and tell them, look, our father came to us last night. He came to all of us. And he told us that I was the one that he wanted to be the next rabbi. Why did he do that? Isn't that more convincing? No, they told you, you're nuts. Now we know you're a liar. Yeah? Right? You get that? Well, in our Torah, the story goes that the Almighty came to all of us. To all of us, and told us, Moshe is my prophet. That's Mount Sinai. Can that story be made up? If it could be made up, then the others would do it. Yeah? Okay, now the Torah's way of presenting this, and this is the only proof that the Torah gives. The Torah says in Deuteronomy, the Almighty Moshe says to the Jewish people, Sha'al no miyomim rishenim. Please. Sha'al means ask. No, please. Please ask of the first days. Of the first days. Miyom heyos odom ala adoma. From when man was first on earth. Go back to the very beginnings, as far back as you can. Mikseh ha-shamayim ad kseh ha-shamayim. From one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. From all people. Back from the beginning. Has this thing, this great thing, ever happened before? Never mind whether it happened. You know, you got to verify whether it happened. Has it ever been said? Anishma kamo means, have you ever heard somebody making the claim? Hashomo am lukim medaba mitocha eish vayechi? Has a nation heard God and lived? Oy, hanisa lukim lekachas legoy mekerev goy. Or, less, has the Almighty come to take a nation from another nation with wonders and with miracles? Ata horeis ladas, you have been shown to see ki Hashem hu lekim, that the Almighty, He is God. So the Torah is telling you, you have been shown to see. This is the proof that the Torah is written into the Torah. If it could have been, it would have been. So the Torah, this is a mighty prophecy. You follow, you could look at it as a mighty prophecy. That after all, religions are a copycat. You understand? If it works with one, or you start your new religion, even if you're crazy, even if you're delusional, you know what works, right? The Almighty came to me in a vision and He said, save my people, right? Religions are copycats. This is one of the old-time religions. It's had some offsprings. So it never occurred to anybody else to say, look, my friends, the Almighty came to all of us. That never occurred to anybody. Why don't you try it today? Start your new religion. It's a great act. But from the beginning of time until now, nobody ever heard of such a thing? That's what it says. You can go and ask. And go and ask. Please, ask. From one end of the world to the other, to all of myth and all, well, you know what, all kinds of stories have been coming out. You won't hear it. That's what it says in the Torah. But it's not the prophecy that you won't hear it. Remember, from the beginning of time until today, all nations, you won't hear it. That's what it says in the Torah. Written out. But it's not a prophecy. It's impossible to hear it. It's historical. Because a nation cannot be told that we were together on Mount Sinai. It cannot be manufactured. History cannot be counterfeit. That's a basic proof, the historical proof of Torah from Sinai in the Torah. Now, one time, this was the proof that the Jewish people walked with. Today, history has lost its crystal clearness. I mean, there's so many lies I'm brooded about, and there's so much propaganda, and so, and who developed the first plane, and Mayo, you don't believe no history. But at the same time, everybody here knows that there was a Roman Empire. Everybody here knows that there was a Greek Empire. There was a guy Alexander. And everybody here knows that there was a guy Moshe. He was real. Just as real as all of them. But we don't know how to sift it out. All right, number two of the another instance of the historical proof is that, look, you fellas heard of Machon Meir. Machon Meir here in Jerusalem said there's a Dov Bigon. He's the guy who's at the head of Machon Meir. This fellow, Dov Bigon, started his career as a kibbutznik. And a kibbutznik in Shomer Tzair, sort of a communist kibbutz. So, this fellow was, his kibbutz was next to a tell, an archaeological site. And the kibbutz decided they're going to do a dig, and why bring in a stranger? They'll send one of their native sons to university, who got his PhD in archaeology, and they'll have something to do, right? Homegrown expert, So they sent him to Hebrew University. He was working on his PhD in archaeology. And for his thesis, they told him, look, go through the prophets, Tanakh, get all the references about a particular site, a particular city, and then from seeing the direction of the march of Yeshua, where he was reported to have conquered first and second and third and fourth, right? And that you can make sort of a straight line. And from the direction that Yeshua, the Shoftim, the different references, you decide where we should look for this city. Do you get it? Because there's some places we know. So from that, you get the general direction, you make a,
and axes, and you sort of focus in as to where the site should be, right? So, okay, that was his thesis. He went through and he started looking and he said, well, the march where they came from the north, the first city, and then the second and the third. And he was working away, and all of a sudden one day he said to himself, what the heck am I doing? I rely on these people being accurate reporters as to the line of march. Yeah? To which cities came first, and they accurately reported which battle and when, and what cities were there, and how many people were there, and this I'm relying on, right? And I'm not relying on them as to what happened. He left the university, he went to Merkaz Harav, and he is the founder of Machon Meir. Right? Now the idea is that, my friend, you believe, you know, that there was a guy Moses, right? You have no question. The Jewish people one time in Egypt. No question about that, right? There's a fellow, they call him Veleshevsky. Veleshevsky, I think his name is, right? Worlds in Collision. You ever hear that book? Right? So, he believes that there were 10 plagues. He got papyrus documents in Egypt. And he shows the evidence that there were really 10 plagues. So he explains how come the 10 plagues came about. I mean, yeah, you got the 10 plagues, you got manna, he had what he considered veracious documents, and he printed them, right? So he comes up with his explanation. What's his explanation? He says, you know, understand, there was a comet that came very close to the earth at that time, and it had an uncommonly large mass. Yeah? So there was a fantastic pull, gravity of the comet to the on the earth, you know, the moon is the moon tide, but this came much closer. So what happened was it pulled the ocean apart just when the Jews came to the Red Sea, right? And they, seeing that the ocean was open and the Egyptians were running after them, they ran into the ocean. And they just got out at the other side when the comet lost its gravity pull. And the Egyptians were in the middle of running after them and the ocean collapsed back on them. You get that? It's not a miracle at all. Very, very simple. And because this comet was so close, so it brought a lot of insects, and that's Kenan. And the water turned red from the petroleum products, and it killed all the fish. And there were petroleum products. And it goes and explains everything. And the manna, you know, 40 years, the manna in the desert. You know what about the 40 years? Very simple. This comet had petroleum products in its makeup, which is itself some marvelous comet, right? But because we don't know from petroleum products in a comet, you know, right? But this one did. And as it came through the atmosphere, so this petroleum was, you know, burnt up. It was scattered as molecules. For a long time afterwards, for 40 years, it came down as a shower. Yeah? But it happened to be that at that time there was an amoeba in the air. There is an amoeba that eats petroleum, right? So there was a bacteria in the air that digested the petroleum as it was coming down. Yeah? And it came down as pre-digested petroleum products, manna, on the ground every morning. Do you understand that you accept? So you say like this, a miracle can't be. So there was this guy Moses, and he went out with the Jewish people, and they were in the desert for 40 years. So then they must have had some way, or it wasn't really 40 years, there weren't that many people. Did you follow? If you accept the veracity of the document, accept it. That's though begun. Why not? Except that you just can't buy it. You can't just buy it. You just can't buy it. That's not the way of a historian. There are truths that are stranger than fiction. Yeah? And God is one of them. Now a third instance in this proof, in the category of the historical proof, is that I just want to focus your attention that at one time,
it was considered arrant nonsense to believe that the Jewish people had a documented history of their kings and the wars going back 3,500 years. It was just ridiculous. And the Bible, the early Bible critics thought that it was like King Arthur's round table, you know, King Ahab and King Baasha and Jehu and ridiculous and Shulman. I mean, how do you believe that stuff? Yeah. How can you believe such nonsense, right? Then they came across documents, as archaeology, they came across documents, Ahab, that he had the war with the Aram, and the fact that Sanherib came out to the old city, and on his way home he was killed by his sons, the way it says it in the Torah, the way it says it in the Bible. Today, outside of the miracles, the Bible is considered absolutely veracious. The Bible, I'm talking about prophets. The events, the wars, the kings, who followed who, when did he live, etc., etc. It's considered absolutely veracious, the most veracious, truthful source of history. It's a little genius, mind-boggling. Documents that old should be that well trusted. A document which is verifiable in so many instances is consistently where it's verifiable turns out to be true, it's considered an absolutely reliable document. Yeah. It's just that you don't feel like coming to the rest of their conclusions. That's not the way of an objective historian. Okay, number five of the categories of proof is the empirical proof. The empirical. Now, what does the empirical mean? What is empirical proof? That's scientific proof. Scientific proof. So, I'll give you a few instances of the scientific character of the proof of Torah from Sinai. Now, one way of scientific proof is that if you want to know whether this milk is uncontaminated, right? You have 1,000 gallons of milk in gallon bottles. What do? You have to take a significant sample, right? So how much is a significant sample? 15 bottles taken at random is more than sufficient. Do you understand? Because if you take 15 samples at random, you check it out, and it's okay, it's not contaminated, yeah? Then you say, if it's at random, then there isn't a significant amount of contamination amongst these bottles. You follow? If you got 50, 100, you don't have to test all 1,000. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, so what would be a scientific examination of Torah, of the veracity of Torah from Sinai? Scientific. Take a random sample of Torah insights, and see, true or not true. So let's take, what's the definition of love? True or not true? Definition of happiness. Free will. Good. True or not true? So you say, well, what about kosher? Look, you can't take a sample if you don't know how to examine it, right? Do you understand? Nobody is saying that kosher is something that you should see that it's kosher or not kosher. We don't know. You have to first learn the ropes. You can't use that as a sampling. Am I making sense? You use a sample of the things that you can examine. So if you take a random sampling, come on, let's take these topics and you check it out. That is proof. That's a scientific proof that the rest of it is true. The second instance is that there's another way. Einstein's theory of relativity was proven. Does anybody know how Einstein's theory of relativity was proven as a fact? Do you remember, Blair? See, Einstein's theory of relativity, they studied the theory of relativity and they decided that if Einstein was correct, then the mass of the sun would curve the space around the sun, right? And a ray of light passing through that space would be twisted off course, right? So if you would see the stars in back of the sun, then you would see them out of position. Really, they're there, right? But inasmuch as it has to curve around the sun, so it's curved around, and it'll look as if they're there. And does that make sense? Yeah? The problem is that you can't see it. A ray of a star in back of the sun, or right near the sun, because the sun is too bright. But there's only one time that you can see it. When is that? An eclipse. So they figured out where it's going to be the next eclipse, and it was in Brazil.
They flew to Brazil, set up their instruments, right? And they're going to see whether there's going to be a displacement of that star. They know where it is on the star map, right? They're going to see whether that star is going to be displaced when the eclipse passes. And sure enough, it was displaced. Proven. If you have a theory, and you make a prediction according to that theory, and it comes true, that's considered proof, empirical proof. You see that, right? Okay, so let's take a look. What predictions would you make on the theory that it was God who gave the Torah on Sinai? Yeah? Wouldn't you say that if God gave the Torah on Sinai, it should be readable today? It's readable today. People are reading it today. 3,500 years. Now, is that predictable? All right, look, let's make a prediction. If a small people amongst mighty empires, yeah, if, what do you say? If it was a normal people, then what would have happened to it? If it's a people with a covenant with God and under God's protection, then what would happen with it? What happened to it? Do you understand? You set up the and see what the result. Yeah. Now, if it's a people who had a religion, you know, a document that they lived by because of faith or whatever it is, so who would their leaders become? On the other hand, if it's God teaching man how to live, who would become their leaders? Do you understand? Who would become the leaders of a people that God has taught about life?
People who know that best.
People who know best. Philosopher kings. Otherwise, who becomes their leader? Boogeymen. Yeah? Or men of power. Do you see that? Philosopher kings? We never have that. All right, now, if they're the small people who come out with ideas that are counter the prejudices of their time, right? Then what happens? Who influences who? But if it's God's people and a covenant of God, then who influences who? Now, what happened in this world? You remember when we came into this world, you know what you did with your neighbor? You ate him. I mean, I don't mean your neighbor, but like, if there was 5 million Africans starving to death and you told the Roman Empire, you came to the Roman Emperor and you say, Emperor, there's starvation amongst the ghosts in France. Shall we send them aid? Hey, yes, sir! We'll send them a band of legionnaires and we will pacify them. Zung! Right? We said, no, we're all humanity. No. And who won? As far as lip service is concerned. Yeah? Peace on earth. Who won? Seventh day Sabbath? Now, the whole world, we won. Yeah. You see that? But you can go on and on. Justice for all, the dignity of the individual. We won. All right, there's a lot more that you can use, but these are the two aspects of the empirical proof. You know, random batch and make predictions and see, you know. These are the two aspects of empirical proof that we've illustrated. Now there's Roman numeral 6, right? Is the experiential proof. The experiential proof is a little more difficult, and it's according to difficulty that we give you. It's a little more difficult to illustrate. You have to partake in it. The experiential proof means you know it's God speaking. Now, if the Torah is God speaking, it should do a little more for you than anything else, right? The Almighty is speaking. Whoa, right?
And it should be discernible whether it's a human being or it's God. It should have a little oomph. The medium is the message. Would you see that? You know, God's being, right? Ding. Except that we are turned off. But how can you see whether it is so or not? Yeah? Now you've got to tune yourself in. So the first instant in Roman numeral six, is if you walk in, objectively, you walk into a base medrash, like the Mir Yeshiva, and sometimes the Nesha Torah, and you walk in there and you see a guy, and he's learning a law. He's learning a law. If an ox gores a cow, and there's nobody around, and we don't know whether the ox was... The cow had a calf before or after. I mean, it's a law case, right? Now, can you imagine walking into a law school and you see the guy singing? If the ox gores the cow, so
that would be a musical, right?
It won't be. I mean, it's not giant. It's not possible. Yeah. Now, if you walk in a basement, you see a guy singing. And you see him carried away. Now, what is he? He's nuts. Or there's some energy in there that he's with. So the second instance is, and it's more difficult because it's, but the second instance is very, it's for the yeshiva student or the Jew who observes this. This is it. You learn 3 hours without stop, yeah? And pause for a moment and see where you are. Put an alarm. 3 hours, I don't care what you learn. Chumash, Mishnah, Gemara, but you just go work at it, yeah? And then pause for a moment, you'll see you've got energy, yeah? You're flying. So you gotta take a reading, yeah?
One last moment, to be a lawyer, we can go out to practice and have their livelihood. Whereas you step in the base midrash, you're not learning to make money, you're not learning for anything.
I say that you've gotten into discussions. Into good quarrels, you know, how, and you went at it, an argument for a couple of hours. When you removed from it, shmendrik, yeah, you were completely involved. Do you understand, Dean? You were completely involved, but at the end of it, you were de-energized. But when you get into this learning and, this is it, not that, not that, and it's an argument, and you're nuts, and that, you know. But there's an excitement. You come out, you're ready to go further. Do you understand the difference? Is it experiential? You know. Any of us have learned Torah, and we know that if you're going out there, if you go to work, friend, Joel, you go to work, anybody, you stay here. We need you. But if you go to work and you get a job, learn 3 hours a day, you'll have a different life. In the morning, before you go to work. You'll have a different life, whatever you do.
And if you miss a day,
you'll feel it, you know, there's something wrong. I don't have energy. So anybody who really gets involved in Torah knows that's it. That's experiential. I say for yeshiva students, experiential proof and the genius proof is final. We live with God. For somebody who's really been into it. All right, now, a third aspect of the experiential proof, and this is a little harder to understand, is that, look, this is the Holy Land, Shabbos, is a holy day. Holy means you're close to God. We say the difference is between light and darkness. It's there. You can see. But the point is, you got to use what? Your finger, you know, how do you tell the difference between light and darkness, Andy? Can I see it with my finger? You gotta use your eyes or you can't see it, right? But I want to hear it. It's a difference. No. You gotta use your eyes. How do you feel the difference? How do you see the difference between a holy day and an unholy day and a mundane day? You gotta use the soul. You're not gonna taste it. You're not gonna touch it. And the time that it's most available, Shabbos, is when it changes, Friday night, and at the Kriyas. And you focus your attention on the Almighty, on the love of God, on the ascetic experience. And zoom.
But it's a little harder because you've got to get the wavelength. You understand? You've got to see it. You've got to see it, but it's there. And it's heavy. And Eretz Yisrael is there. It's heavy. You gotta be aware. When you get back to America, watch. It's everything is black. Dark. You remember, David? You remember, I saw that. I saw it in your face. Yeah. Alright, but these are the instances of the experiential proof. We have one more category. Category number 7 is the pragmatic proof. The pragmatic proof we only include in the categories of proof because in the United States and the Western world today, pragmatism takes hold. And pragmatism really is not like evidence of the other 6 where your perception is so. Pragmatism goes on the basis that let's be reasonable. What works is true. Yeah? It's not really a proof, but it's just reasonable to do something that helps you. That's pragmatism. There is no absolute truth, only the thing that helps you. That's true. Do you understand? Okay, so an instance of the pragmatic proof of Torah from Sinai is I know people who became religious Jews. You know why? They had a kid. Now, what does that have to do with becoming a religious Jew? How do you raise? What are they going to do? We're going to teach them there is a God, there isn't a God. You got morality. How do you know morality? They took their job seriously. They said, what framework are we going to use? What framework will you use to teach your children? You shouldn't lie. Why not? I mean, you've got to believe in it. Yeah? Why not? Well, it's wrong. I mean, if people are serious, they know it's wrong. Where is it wrong? What's wrong? Is there a God? Why not? But people who are serious about the responsibility of raising a kid, they say, I need a framework. So which framework should I take? I'll be a Jew. I know people who actually became religious Jews because they practice it. Now, do you hear that? That's pretty practical people. Yeah? But number 2 is, did you ever say to someone, I envy you, your convictions? I envy you, your solidity, your roots. Did you ever say that to someone? Did you ever hear anyone who say that? People envy you, your meaning, your Shabbat, your convictions, your commitments, right? So don't envy me. Join me. Yeah. Number 3 of an instance of the pragmatic proof is, tell me, my friend, who would you rather marry? A religious girl who believes in morality and don't dilly-dally? Who believes that you gotta stick it out in the thick and thin? Who believes that you have to be honest? Who is bound by ethics and responsibilities and believes in devoting her time to her children and to fulfill her responsibilities to a family and her husband? Who would you rather? You guys aren't very practical. But let me tell you, every girl would rather marry a religious guy. Just to know that they got a faithful husband. David says, yeah. Right? See, isn't it? Well, the guy's reliable. He'll come home, he'll take care of his responsibilities. He's going to work for the family. He's not going to flitter around. Yeah? You guys aren't practical. She's a pretty fluff. It's no big deal, you know. Right? They're practical. Women are practical. They're pragmatic. They know who makes a good husband. Who needs one of these playboys? You know? Oh, a nice religious guy. It's just, I have to be religious. They don't like that too much, but now getting a religious guy, that makes a lot of sense. Do you understand what I'm saying? Pragmatically, it's good for the family. It's good. It makes good children. It makes good, right? The 4th instance of the pragmatic proof is, my friend, if you were an objective guy from Mars, right? You had to accept the system. You take a look at Western civilization, and what do you see?
cracks. I mean, how old is it? 200 years old, American democracy, right? Yeah? Liberalism. Yeah? Whatever is going on. Doing it. They got violence. They're killing each other. They're treating each other as objects. Look at it. Family life is disintegrated. People don't want to work. All the Jewish people, 3,500 years, family life, values, moral, education. Which would you choose? All right, there's just one more instance of the pragmatic proof. Let me tell you, my friend. Did you ever hear the People's Republic, the New Republic of Plato? Anybody read the New Republic? You did, Dean.
The New Republic?
The Republic. What is it? The Republic of Plato, right? So you remember he says over there that we have to create a myth to make it work. We have to create a myth. You remember? Tell him about this myth. You remember the details?
The subject of the class is to take care of the people and have to believe in something.
So we'll tell them that the Almighty created men, their bronze, or their silver, or their gold, and we'll tell you who you are, so whether you're a leader. So why should one guy believe in the other guy, right? Why should he listen to him? So for the proper republic, we'll see who's the intelligent fellows, and we'll call them gold men, right? And everybody will accept that, so they'll follow their leadership, right? But you need a system to make things work. And he made up this myth. So I would suggest, you know, that really to make things work, what do we need? We need people who are 100% committed to do the right thing. Fearless. Know that in the end, nothing counts but the right thing. Yeah? And fearlessly independent to be able to look at truth no matter where it leads them. Right? Because they have to be able to get rid of prejudices if you want to get people on, I mean, a society onto the, right? So you have to be able to confront truth no matter what, not be afraid of the consequences, yeah? And independent, even if it's against society. At the same time, we have to have people who are willing to listen to people who know more than them, yeah? And we have to have people who are willing to follow authority, even if it's against what they perceive. You get this, independent and willing to follow authority, even if it's against their own perception, because otherwise it will tear each other apart, right? Same time, you want these people to be intellectuals, to seek to understand it, and at the same time, they have to be practical and be concerned with details, etc., etc. Yeah? You get it? All these things to make the perfect society. So you know what? I suggest that we invent this Torah. You see, it does the job, right? It does the job. You got to know yourself, yeah? And you got to follow the authority. And you got to work like the devil and the heck with the consequences. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That makes you do all the right things, right? Yeah? Love humanity. Same time, look for their faults. Correct their faults. That is a beautiful job, right? The only thing is, how do we get people to accept that they have to listen to this Torah? You know what? God gave it. You see that? They don't want to make up a myth. Pragmatically, come on. Just one more instance, and that is, my friend, if we're going to defeat the threat of a third world war, then we need people who believe that it can be done. Yeah? At the same time, we have some framework for searching for the solution, relying on each other and trusting each other and working together. You know, there's a lot of people who think that they have the solution, but they kill each other, right? How are we going to do that? I suggest that we'd have to develop some kind of legend to make people look at the reality, take action, take full responsibility. The buck stops here. Be willing to reason together, committed until the last drop of blood, not afraid, and
conviction that it can be done. You have a substitute? I'm almost ready to join you. Come on, let's get it done. Okay, now, that's the seven categories of proof of Torah from Sinai. Knowing, as we said in the commandment, to know means what? First,
belief. The perception without really clarity. Then get it into clarity. That's the evidence. And get it clear.
But that's still not knowing. You know when you know? You know when you know?
When you live it. When you feel it. And the example we give is that, God forbid, somebody tells you your father is dead.
So, faith, a leap of faith is, it can't be. You're making a mistake. It's impossible. I'm having a nightmare. This is crazy. You're crazy. I'm crazy. Yeah? That's all kinds of way to avoid that consequence, right? That's leaps of faith. Belief is, you take a look and you see. He's not crazy. You're not having a nightmare. That's your perception. It's not what you feel like believing, right? But it's your perception. Knowledge is,
if it's coming from a real verifiable source, or you see your father, or whatever it is, that's knowledge, that's clarity.
But you don't really know until maybe a long time later, after the funeral, until you feel you'll never be able to speak to your daddy.
Do you understand?
That's when the realization is home. So there's a lot of people in this world who believe in God. And there are quite a few who believe in Torah from Sinai, that the Almighty spoke to man. But there are very few who realize what they're talking about, or appreciate what these words mean. And that is to get it home to your realization. The Almighty, creator of this universe, is with us right now. And the Almighty, creator of this universe, who makes your atoms tick, He told you, be happy. Makes a little difference. A way of realizing what you're talking about. He demands that you know what you know. He says, you better know this, son. That's a whole category of knowledge that's called v'hashivos elavecho. Yedata hayom, and know today, v'hashivos elavecho. It's the last sentence in the Olenu, the first paragraph of the Olenu. You shall know today, and you should bring it back to your emotional realization. Hashem Olakim, the Almighty, He is God, Hashemayim Ma'al, Allah Shemtoch HaSeinai. He is the Almighty. And that is a process of itself, and that's the next section. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.